From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. For weeks, our telephones and televisions and computer screens have been saturated with pictures of inconsolable toddlers behind fences and bereft parents reaching for their children. The scenes from America's southern border were so powerful that the public and politicians from both parties pressured the administration to end its policy of separating children from parents picked up for crossing the border. Yesterday, President Trump signed an executive order allowing families to be detained together. Reporter Emily Curitan is in Texas and spent some time at the border wading through the chaos and the tears. And she joins me now from KERA in Dallas. Hello, Emily. Thank you for making time for us.
You're very welcome, Virginia. Happy to be here.
So you spend 5 days or so in El Paso near the border. Let's start with your time there. Who was there?
Yeah, well, when I got there, I drove in on I-10 across Texas to a town called Tornillo, which we had been told was the site for a detention center for unaccompanied minors that were crowded out of the immigration system since the family separation policy took effect. And what I found was a small Texas town with a port of entry, about 1,000 to 1,500 people living there, depending on the time of year, because it's a predominantly farming community. And when I got to this detention center, what it looked like was really almost straight out of like a movie or something, kind of like the tent in E.T. The tent itself is an industrial-grade, large, white tent. And inside, at least 100 boys, we were told 16 to 17-year-old boys, were being held under the care of the Department of Health and Human Services. And no one from the press, very few lawmakers at the time I was there. This may have changed as of today, actually. But at the time, HHS was not letting anyone in this tent. And even the people who were able to sort of strong arm or know someone to get in and gave me their reports back out said they didn't talk to the boys or see them. So, you know, a lot of our information is based on through this chain of people trying desperately to cobble it together and going through their elected officials rather than just having, for example, the last time this site was used to detain entire families during the Obama administration. It was a processing center where people stayed from 2 to 10 days. The press got tours and they walked through, and that was not the case in Tornillo near El Paso, where I was.
So a decided change in getting information from authorities. But how about the people that you met there at the scene? Were there people there for humanitarian reasons?
There certainly were. On Sunday, a congressman from Texas, a native of El Paso, actually organized a march on Tornillo. And it was Father's Day, right during the Mexico World Cup game. We weren't expecting a lot of people. At least 2,000 turned out, more than live in this town. And they marched in the El Paso summer sun, which is not to be tangled with. It was very hot. They marched towards this port of entry, chanting, Liberen nuestros niños, free our children, and rallied behind these Democratic lawmakers. Joe Kennedy from Massachusetts actually showed up, giving the event even more of a national profile. So people there were really outraged by the idea that inside this compound were children who had been separated from their parents.
Well, it wasn't just Democratic leaders. In fact, Georgia Senator Johnny Isaacson, among the Republicans who broke with the president and calling for an end to the policy. So even some people who've taken a hard line on immigration have been moved by images from the border. Do you get any sense of the public response there in Texas, where so much of this story is taken and has taken place?
Yeah, my experience was certainly in West Texas, and we did have some crossing the aisle. For example, Congressman Will Hurd of Texas, a Republican, he's actually one of the first people to get inside of the detention center with a state rep, a Democrat that he brought with him, and that was our early reports that we got back out. So there was some opposition there. In the town of El Paso and in the town of Tornillo, where this camp was, everyone I spoke to, whether they you know, sought, you know, a broader pathway to citizenship, whatever their stance on immigration and cases of illegal entry or asylum seeking or border jumping, whatever language they used, no one I met was in favor of the family separation policy. And the words they chose would vary depending on if I was in Tornillo, where 99% of the population is Mexican-American, or if I was at the airport in El Paso talking to people right at the doorstep of Fort Bliss, a military installation with, you know, strong ties to Homeland Security and the Border Patrol.
Emily, you covered Georgia for a long time for GPB. Is there a palpable difference, do you think, in response compared to the other southern states that you've traveled through recently?
You mean in Texas?
Yes, in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, going back to this area where I had also lived for years as a newspaper reporter, I think people on the border, I spoke to a woman, for example, living in Tornillo, who works in the kitchen of a big house there on a pecan plantation. And that's where many of the jobs in this place are. You know, her attitude seemed to in many ways encompass what I heard from state representatives there, from other people, which was that they were outraged at the family separation policy. You know, as a parent, as a mother, Hilda Prieto, who I talked to, said, you know, that's not a good condition for a kid. However, the conditions of the camp may have been somewhat of a distraction from some of the bigger issues that those people are facing. She said to me, for example, that, you know, here in Tornillo, we don't have clean water. It's contaminated with arsenic. The boys in that camp get their water driven in. Our kids might not have air conditioning, might not have flushable toilets. We're one of the poorest communities in Texas. So, you know, I heard that echoed a couple of times, and that seeing this tent pop up where it was in a place where people have to work really hard to make sure they have basic services was a message about priorities that also made them mad, in addition to the family separation policy.
Now, you did leave Tornillo yesterday, but now that the president has signed this executive order, do you know what the protocol is for reuniting families?
I don't, and I don't believe anybody does at this point. Over 2,000 kids have been separated from their parents or their guardians or the people they came into this country with since that policy took effect. And as for the boys in Tornillo, we know there's at least 100 of them, perhaps closer to 200 at this point. Their future is unclear, and we're not sure when and if they'll be reunited.
I'm speaking with Emily Curiton. She's a reporter who recently visited America's southern border. Now, that's where the practice of separating families has been creating chaos and some public outrage for weeks. Marie Marquardt is also with me. She's here in the studio. Marie is a scholar in residence at Emory and an advocate for detainees, particularly at the Stewart Detention Center that is in Lumpkin County. Marie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Virginia.
Now, like the rest of us, you've been watching this on TV and the internet and heard some of the audio that was smuggled out. Tell me, what was your reaction to that?
You know, I think my reaction is similar to the reaction of most of the American people and certainly of parents. It's heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching, impossible to imagine, really, that we had come to this point as a nation.
How about when you heard about the executive order, though, to keep people at least detained together, families?
I'm ambivalent about that. I mean, on the one hand, I'm so grateful that we no longer will see children and parents separated from one another as a part of U.S. policy. I also, as someone who spends a lot of time in immigration detention, am deeply concerned about the possibility of a future in which we have large numbers of families detained together for perhaps an unspecified amount of time, particularly for asylum seekers. This process can be very long. And if the administration intends to detain them during the entire process of seeking asylum, we will have families living for very long periods of time in conditions that are really incredibly difficult conditions for adults.
Well,
so I can't imagine children there.
Well, I want to get more of a picture of the Stewart Detention Center. But let me ask you first, there are now an estimated 11,000 minors in U.S. detention centers. So some form of this has been going on for some time. You've worked with immigrants and migrants and detainees and families for years. Is this story different?
Right. Qualitatively, there certainly are some differences. I mean, we have never before seen parents and children removed from each other in this way, so that children are taken into the situation of being unaccompanied minors. But there are definitely consistencies. I mean, one of the things is that we see is that children are... minors are taken into the custody of HHS, and they're in a different type of facility than the detention facilities that are either run by ICE or, in most cases, run by private corporations that contract with ICE. And the detention facilities that are run by ICE and the private corporations that contract with ICE have really faced some enormous pushback about the conditions inside those facilities. And then, of course, the facilities that we're seeing being discussed and being built in that border region. Again, I think all of us can look at what's the possibilities are there and know that that is not a place for children to thrive or even to survive at the basic level.
I should note that that figure, the 11,000, does not distinguish between those who crossed the border with their parents and those who did so alone during the unaccompanied minors rush to the border
in
2014.
So I think there are about 2,200 that were separated from their parents
since May 5th,
in that group.
From May 5th to June 9th.
That's right.
So, Emily, as you said, you were used to report in this area. Do you see a difference in this story now and when you were covering border issues back then?
Yeah, I see a difference. And an advocate in El Paso that I talked to saw a big difference. He works for a human rights network that was actually allowed to tour the Tornillo facility in November of 2016 at the request or the invitation of CBP under, that's Customs and Border Patrol under the Obama administration. And the big difference is in intention. As you just said, back then, these families, family units, or single adults, whoever would end up in Tornillo was there temporarily, and it was meant to be a solution to overcrowding in places like Stewart, where you might have 16 people in a cell intended for four. And people would move through this camp relatively quickly. And now, with the executive order yesterday, while it ends the family separation on separation policy on paper, it also introduces this idea of indefinite detainment as the president seeks an exemption from the Flores settlement, which is the legal precedent for why you can't hold children longer than 20 days in the United States. So it's opening the door to a different intention, and that's a huge shift in perspective from when I was last working on the border.
Well, and that is a question, the idea of how long it will take people who are asylum seekers to actually be granted asylum. Do we know anything right now about the average amount of time or whether that actually happens in many cases? Emily, I don't know if you want to pick that up or if you've got the data on it, or Marie.
Well, for there's the process for detained asylum seekers is a different process than it is for asylum seekers who are seeking asylum from outside of detention. For detained asylum seekers, it's typically called defensive asylum, and that process, you know, can run anywhere from 6 months to, if it's on appeal, years. We've worked at Stewart Detention Center with asylum seekers who are there for several months, and with asylum seekers who are there for, in fact, just this week we had an asylum seeker that we had been working with who was in detention for 3 years appeal for his asylum case, and finally was granted asylum. But that is an incredibly long time to imagine children being detained with their families. And again, if Flores is overturned, that is likely what we'll be facing. I should also note it is very hard to get asylum defensively. So it's important, I think, when people are able to be released from detention, seek the support of their family networks, find legal representation, they're going to have a much better chance of making a case, they have a legitimate case for asylum, but they're going to have a much better chance of making that case if they're able to do it from outside of detention.
Emily, 30 seconds. You wanted to pick something up there?
Yeah, just that we do have indications that sites within the Department of Defense, that means military bases, are being considered as the places where you're going to see this play out, where families may be living, whether it's indefinitely, whether we continue to honor the Flores settlement. Only time here right in front of us is going to tell, and we may see these families detained on military bases.
Emily Kiraton, reporter, formerly with GBB, soon to be the Central Oregon Bureau Chief for OPB. Emily, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck in your new post.
You're very welcome.
Marie Marcourt, please stay with us. Marie is a scholar in residence at Emory and advocate for detained immigrants. And when we return, we're going to consider that relationship between detention and immigration in America, now and historically. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're talking today about the relationship between detention and immigration in America, both currently as well as historically. We are not here to debate immigration policy, but to get the long view of how immigrants, legal and otherwise, have been regarded and treated. Marie Marcourt is with us. She's a scholar in residence at Emory, founder of El Refugio. This is a Georgia-based nonprofit that serves detainees and their families. Marie, your work with El Refugio focuses on both the detainees and their families. So let's start with the detainees. Who are they?
So El Refugio is a mile down the road from the Stewart Detention Center, and I worked with a wonderful group of people to get it off the ground in 2010. And it is a 1,900-bed facility. It's an all-male facility. And I would say it's difficult to know at any particular moment who is detained there, but we do visit with a pretty high proportion of detainees there. And the detainees there are either asylum seekers who have been apprehended at the border, much like the families that we're hearing about now, and transported to the Stewart Detention Center during the course of their asylum proceedings. There is a court right there at Stewart, an immigration court. Or they are immigrants who've been living in the United States, particularly in the Southeast, in many cases for many, many years, decades even, with families, citizen children. Those immigrants may have been detained in a county that has an agreement with the federal government to enforce immigration for, you know, something as simple as driving without a driver's license, or perhaps for any other violation that would bring them into contact with immigration and customs enforcement.
But this is just men, no children.
It is all male. Yes,
so
no women.
What
no
do
children.
You? And I'm going to try and say this right. El refugio,
yes.
Refugio.
Beautiful.
And do how did you help their families?
So the first thing we do, the most simple thing, is we're a ministry of hospitality. So we have a small, modest home a mile down the road from the detention facility. And in that home, every weekend, we host families who are coming from great distances to visit their loved ones in detention. We offer them free food and lodging, emotional support in very, very difficult times, and try and accompany them through the crisis and help them in any way that we can. In some cases, material support for transportation. We'll have to recall that in most cases, the primary breadwinner in the family is the one who's been detained. So they're both under enormous financial distress as well as emotional distress.
So you yourself have brought many people there. You've spent a lot of time at the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia. Can you give our listeners a sense of what it is like, you know, a way that they can picture it?
Mm-hmm. So we have a visitation program as well, and we bring volunteers every weekend to visit with detained immigrants who have no one else to visit with them. And it is, I have been doing this now since probably almost a decade, but with El Refugio since 2010. And I'm always overwhelmed by the experience of entering that facility. It never ceases to overwhelm me. The facility runs very much like a medium security prison would. It's an enormous building without exterior windows, with double gates with razor wire fences that you have to go through to enter. And when we visit in the same way that family members would visit. We enter into a room with a glass partition, little cubicles and telephones, and we speak through the partition to the detained immigrant who we're visiting. And because we're visiting with family members, we also have the, you know, often really heartbreaking experience of being visiting the person that we're visiting right beside a family, maybe a young child, seeking to connect with her father through this glass partition. There are only 5 visitation windows or areas
for 1,900
facility with 1,900 men. Yes.
Wow. So it sounds like it's like visiting someone in prison.
It's absolutely. It's precisely like visiting someone in prison. The men wear, you know, jumpsuits. They're moved through the facility in a way that is exactly the same way that a prisoner would be moved through a facility. And I think this is really important for us to note because, very few of these people have criminal convictions, and certainly asylum seekers don't. They have a legal right to seek asylum, and they are simply exercising their right to seek asylum, but having to be held in detention during the period of time that they're doing that.
I want to invite a couple more voices in here. We're trying to get a variety of perspective. Ibram Kendi is with us, as is Matthew Hashiguchi. Ibram is a professor of African American history and the director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center. That's at American University in Washington. Joining us by phone from Washington. Hello, Ibram.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. A heavy subject that we're talking about today. A lot to pick through. Matthew Hashiguchi is an assistant professor in multimedia and film and production at Georgia Southern University. He's a documentary filmmaker whose work uncovers diverse experiences. Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're not considering this as a partisan issue, but giving some historical context, we do know that Georgia Republican Senator Isaacson and evangelicals who sided with the president on social issues, the president's wife and daughter, also all urged a change in this policy that has stirred so many people up. So I want to begin by asking each of you what these images and the reporting and separation of families at the border brought to mind. How about you, Ibram? You want to begin?
Well, I think for me, they brought to mind a particular particular sort of perspective that these people need to be detained because there's something necessarily wrong with them, as opposed to these people seeking in the United States what other people historically have sought here. And so I think it's hard to talk about this issue without talking about politics. But I think in talking about any issue, whether partisan or nonpartisan, we should talk about people as people. And clearly, many of these people have been described in ways that don't have to do with them being people as animals, as you know, gangbangers, when these are really people. And I think first and foremost, those messages that do not describe these people as people is one of the first things that comes to my mind.
Yeah, this is some of the language that has been used, you know, an infestation, that kind of thing feels dehumanizing. Matthew, you have made a film about Japanese internment and looking at your own ancestry and history. Tell me what you see when you saw those pictures.
It's pretty disgusting. I think the Japanese Americans have been compared to a lot of the groups that are being currently persecuted. And to me, the similarities that I see are between the American perspective of the past and the present day American perspective and who Americans view as belonging here. So, you know, it applied to Japanese Americans, Irish, Italians, Hispanics, Arabs. So I think this mindset of these people don't belong has been consistent throughout American history.
But the acceptance of those who are acceptable, you know, we've seen this before with Haitian immigrants, the Mariel Boatlift, and of people from Cuba. People were detained in fences, chain link fences. So how has that shifted? Marie, you're shaking your head, so I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting if we look over the course of history. This is cyclical, right? This is a cyclical problem that we face. And I think now we've got a problem of the magnitude. But we also are kind of in this cycle again, in which, you know, Americans, a nation that, you know, has a history, is a history of migrants coming from all over the world, in many cases because they're fleeing persecution. Of course, that's the founding of our nation. Decide that, you know, certain migrants are unacceptable and others are welcome. And I believe that decision is very much linked to our nation's disease of racism and xenophobia, a disease that's continuing to plague us in ways that are going to prohibit us, hinder us from moving forward to be the nation that we promised to be and to be the nation that we are.
Well, Ibram, you are an anti-racist researcher. I'm just wondering, what do you have to add to that? Is there any real data it's an attitude. It's very difficult to measure. But how do you look at this?
Well, I mean, surveys consistently show that Americans think that there's something wrong or inferior about particular racial groups, even though studies demonstrate that those things are not true. Even people believe that Latino immigrants are sort of criminals and rapists, when in fact the data disputes that. And so I think many Americans have been led to believe that there's something wrong with groups of people, you know, as opposed to recognizing the ways in which we are equal. And because we think something is wrong with groups of people, because we fear groups of people, we're able to be easily manipulated by powerful people that allows them to basically gain our vote or our backing, thinking that they're going to help us when in fact they're not. And so I think, to me, the most difficult aspect of this disease is the way in which it sort of prevents you from really looking at reality. You know, in reality, you know, as she stated, is that, you know, American history is the history of not only indigenous people, but immigrants. And I know a lot of people who are not indigenous people, and I don't know of any of them whose ancestors are not immigrants.
That's Ibram
Kendi. Forced or otherforced or non-forced.
Ibram, thank you. Ibram Kendi, he is a professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C. Also with me, filmmaker Matthew Hashiguchi and also Marie Marquardt. And I feel like we need to get some legal perspective here. Christina Iturralde is with us. She's managing editor at KIND. That's Kids in Need of Defense. Christina, so welcome, first of all. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
Well, so what we run into here is a number of different issues. Obviously, it's a very complicated thing. But the difference in those seeking asylum, those just coming to the United States for work, obviously, that is one of the big dividers, legal and illegal points of entry. Help us pick through this and wade through the idea of asylum seekers. Why does someone seek asylum?
Sure. And, you know, just to clarify, I'm the managing attorney here at the office, not an editor. But I just want to clarify that the folks that are arriving at the borders right now, you know, these families, these mothers with children, men and children, both, you know, anyone that really arrives at our gates are actually doing the legal process, which is to present themselves and seek asylum. So I think that there's a lot of confusion about sort of their status, about the issues involved from a legal perspective. So, you know, they are doing what is required of someone that's, you know, fleeing persecution, of someone who cannot return to their country safely. The children that we work with every day in our office, we work with unaccompanied minor children. So this segment of individuals arriving at our borders, we've always treated them slightly differently since the Flores Agreement was put into place in 1997. So these children, they are supposed to be treated differently. They are not supposed to be confined in detention centers the way adults are. However, you know, all along we've had, you know, families arriving at these borders, so women and children primarily, and what to do about them. You know, this has been a problem, not only under this administration, previous to this administration. I think that this is something that, you know, has been a confounding issue and one that's not easy to treat, really. So with women and children, we've previously under the Obama administration and even before that, have placed families in detention centers. You know, you might remember the Hutto detention center that was shut down after massive human rights violations were happening inside of that detention center, including sexual abuse of women and children. So we have had these problems before.
In fact, I want to get that to that longer view. When did immigrants coming to America go from being detained to actually placed in detention?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that this is sort of a longer view. You know, I think that we've had detained immigrants long back into the 80s, and if you'd have to do a more historic dive into each law that's created an increasing amount of detention of individuals. So, you know, for us as an organization, we work with unaccompanied minors, like I said, and what's been sort of tragic as a result of the zero tolerance policy is that what's happened is they've, you know, taken children away from their parents at the border, have put them into the same system and process that we have been dealing with unaccompanied minors, and these children are going to get lost in the process. So the over 2,000 children that we've been discussing that have been torn away from their families, this is going to be a long process of trying to figure out how to reunify them with their families, because in their cases, unlike our unaccompanied minors who are often fleeing abuse, abandonment, and neglect by their parents, they were in the loving arms of their parents and were taken away from that situation, and that's, you know, unfortunately, a new crisis, an added crisis to the already standing crisis of how do we work with these children to make sure that they aren't in detained settings? How do we get them attorneys so that they can work on their case, so that they can actually remain in the United States if this is in their best interest, if it is the best place that they could possibly be? Many of these children cannot return to their countries because they are asylum seekers fleeing persecution as well.
We've got just a minute left. Matthew, I want to turn to you about, you know, the detention of immigrants and the difference in detaining its own citizens. It was Japanese American citizens who were held in the aftermath of World War II or during World War II. Quickly, before we run up to that break, how do you see that difference here? Citizens, non-citizens, do we regard them differently?
You know, bringing up the Japanese-American, whether they were citizens or not is important because two-thirds of those that were incarcerated during World War II were American-born citizens. So this isn't – right now, this is an immigration issue. In the past, it hasn't been an immigration issue, at least in regards to Japanese-Americans. So those who are American were also at threat and could also be at threat now or in the future. So it's – to me, it's much more about who do we think belongs here versus should we allow these people to immigrate here.
Well, let's hold on to that conversation right now. Ibram Kendi, I know we have to let you go. I'm so sorry. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
But we're sticking around with Marie Marquardt and also Christina Etteraldi. She is managing attorney at KIND and filmmaker Matthew Hashiguchi. Stay with us. We're going to get into some more of the historical 20th century perspective on internment and detention of immigrants. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to look at some of the innovative ways that Georgia's universities are recruiting and advising and retaining at-risk students. And we'd love to hear from you. What kept you in college or what kept you from going to college? You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457. We're at OST Talk on Twitter and on Facebook. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Today, I'm speaking with Marie Marquardt from Emory and El Refugio and Matthew Hashiguchi. He's a documentary filmmaker and professor of multimedia and film and production at Georgia Southern University. And also with us is Christina Etteraldi. She's managing attorney at KIND, which stands for Kids in Need of Defense. Well, Marie, I want to go to you first. The morality of this is in question. You know, we're trying to untangle those things that have happened in the past and in the present. There's so many issues and so much context around all of them, but it seems like a central flowing through this is morality. And, you know, President Reagan, for example, apologized for the internment of Japanese citizens of America during World War II. There were reparations made to them. There's a difference, of course, in acknowledging reparations and morality. But how do you think we're going to be looking back at this?
I think about that often. I think about that in particular when I hear our political leaders speak from their own faith traditions. I am a scholar in residence at the School of Theology at Emory, so I spend a lot of time thinking and learning and reflecting on what it is to be a person of faith who is addressing the issues that we're facing right now. It is clear and consistent, the theme of the call to welcome the stranger, because we ourselves were once strangers in the land of
Egypt. I'm sorry I have to interrupt, but I have to ask you about Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, quoting from the New Testament, the Bible, to
Romans 13.
Yeah,
right.
So
yeah, so that was shocking and also deeply disturbing because, you know, what Attorney General Sessions did in that moment was he cherry-picked a piece of scripture when he had access to an enormous body of scripture in both the Jewish sacred texts and the Christian sacred texts, so in the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, and also in the New Testament, that, again, is consistent from Genesis forward, that Christians, there is no ambiguity about this. Christians and Jews are called to welcome the stranger. And in fact, that very Romans 13, if you read through to the end of the chapter, what Paul says in Romans 13 is he says that we are expected to submit to the governing authority, but that God's law always supersedes the law of the governing authority. And God's law is the law of love. And the law of love is that we must love our neighbor as ourselves. Well, the Central Americans and asylum seekers from around the world that are coming to knock at the doors of our southern border are indeed our neighbors. And then, of course, I would urge Attorney General Sessions to look at Matthew 25, which is pretty clear about what must we do to enter the kingdom of heaven, feed the hungry, give drink to the
thirsty.
I think there are probably competing viable versus for many different things, as there are competing visions of what the country should be and its stance on immigration. And of course, people who are immigration hardliners would say, well, they crossed illegally, they shouldn't be here. Let's talk about the legality of that. Christina, I want to turn to you. Give us a sense of, first of all, there's been much discussion about whether or not it was policy or law to separate children at the border. What do you think legal scholars are going to say looking back at this?
Right. Well, I think that this was very much sort of smoke and mirrors, right? When the president said that it was binding law on him to have to separate these families, that isn't in fact the case. This was a policy that Jeff Sessions announced, publicly on May 7th, and before that with his attorney generals across the country, or attorneys, I'm sorry, across the country, under the Department of Justice, who received the message back in April. The zero tolerance policy that we're currently sort of living under is a new policy. It's not law. It's something that this administration decided to do. Not only that, but we have alternatives to detention that aren't even on the table, that aren't being discussed right now by our current administration that should be considered. Why do we find it acceptable as a society to put asylum seekers into detention centers when there are many different alternatives, including alternatives that would use up-to-the-minute technology, to help ensure that individuals show up to their immigration court hearings. That's something that hasn't even been really discussed fully, and I would love to see sort of a shift in the discussion about whether or not this is even necessary. Putting families into what is essentially internment camps, unfortunately, we do have this horrible history in America of thinking of detention as something acceptable. We've done it, generation after generation for different groups, and definitely, I think one of your commentators before said, it's not just immigrants. We did this to Japanese Americans, U.S. citizens. We rounded them up and we put them into these camps, and unfortunately, the camps that we're seeing on these images right now are very much akin to what we saw before. And I think it's sort of desensitized all of us that we have seen these things before. And it is sort of palatable to a certain segment of our society that thinks that this is the way that we should be going towards. But I think I hope in the majority of people who don't feel like this is acceptable, that we shouldn't be putting babies in cages, that we shouldn't be putting families in military bases, that just shouldn't be what America does, that isn't American.
Well, it is a 2 out of 3 Americans polled do disagree with the policy. And just to follow up, figures from ICE that I saw today, 98% of people actually do show up for their immigration or asylum trials. But I do need to turn to Matthew, because you brought up the Japanese internment camps. And Matthew, you've done a lot of work on this study. You made a film about it, and you talked to a number of people who were interned. Give me a sense of their feelings about their own country, because they were, in many cases, Americans.
What I found really fascinating is that they were some of the strongest Americans that I have ever met. They were people that, in the face of this persecution and in this experience, they never turned their back on their country. They're people that will stand up during the national anthem. They're people that vote. They're people that take part in American society, even through all this that happened. And I think it's something that I found very unique amongst the older Japanese American people, is this positive outlook. So that was really strange to see that there's a positive perception, even though this experience was horrible. They were constantly looking on the bright side of things.
How do you explain that? Any theories or any sort of sense in speaking to all those people of why they so willingly embraced the country that had interned them?
I think they were trying very hard to be American and to blend in. And the way to do that in their mind was to not fight back, to do as told, and to not make a fuss. And I think that's something that has lasted through generations of at least Japanese Americans, to not raise their voice, to not be heard, not be the nail that sticks up and gets hit with the hammer. But there's very much a positive outlook on that experience. You know, for example, I was born because of the internment camps. If this did not happen, my grandparents would not have met in Cleveland, Ohio, gotten married. So they look at their lives now and they say, you know, we experienced this decades ago, but right now our lives are good. And therefore, things happen for a reason. And, you know, there's this saying, Shigatsuganai, what is, is. You can't do anything about it. And that's kind of their perception of it. But I don't think that perception has lasted through younger generations of Japanese Americans, because right now you have a lot of upset and very vocal Japanese Americans who are speaking out on behalf of their parents or grandparents about this experience.
I'm wondering, all of us have been following this story, obviously, and it's something that we hear the same terms discussed, you know, on both sides, and I'm going to make it binary in this case. But what are we missing from this conversation? What kind of conversation or conversations should we be having about what's going on right now?
I would say, you know, I go back, well, two things. The first, I want to go back to something that Christina said. One of the enormous things policy-wise that's missing from this conversation at this moment is that we're being presented with the claim that we have two options. You know, option A is separate children from their families. Option B is indefinitely detain families together. And that simply is not the case. We have good examples of alternatives to detention that have been used in the past. And as you mentioned, asylum seekers want to be granted asylum in the United States. So they want to show up in court and they want to go through the process. That's, I think it's important for us to inject into the conversation a reminder that we do not only have two options, we have many options. The second thing, and this kind of comes back to the morality, I mentioned that the call to welcome the strangers because we ourselves were once strangers. I would just urge us all to spend some time putting ourselves into the shoes and into the experience of the folks whose images we're seeing and hearing about, and to imagine what it would be to make the decision to journey for probably a month through the interior of Mexico in a dangerous situation, to travel in the heat of summer, to arrive in the United States because you believe that this would be a place of refuge for yourself and your children, especially for your children in this case. I just urge us into a mode of compassion and to know that we as a country, we're intelligent people. We can come up with better ways to do this than we're doing it now. We do not have to rely on detention facilities.
That's Marie Marquardt. She's scholar in residence at Emory. Matthew Hashiguchi is assistant professor in multimedia film and production at Georgia State Southern University. I'm so sorry. He's also the documentary filmmaker who made Good Luck Soup. You can find more about that film online. And Christina, I want to thank you so much, Matthew, for being able to join us, especially at the last minute. We appreciate it.
Yeah, sure thing.
And Marie, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And Christina Iturralde Thomas. She's managing attorney at KIND, which helps kids in need of defense. Christina, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you touching on all these issues.
You may have seen this photo floating around social media, a woman, right hand raised in a fist, left hand on the autobiography of Malcolm X. That was Mariah Parker being sworn in as member of the Athens-Clark County Commission. But Commissioner Parker has another life, well, actually two, as a linguistics graduate student and as rapper Lingua Franca. We caught up with Parker in Athens last week to talk about hip-hop, politics, and life.
Next week is gonna beat the rest of them. I'm waking up at 7, stretching and eating vegetables, cause beating my demons could never be fearsome. It's feeding them and feeling them, beating up all my eardrums.
I think that like all the things that made me a viable candidate for office and that make me a good representative for my community, I learned through being a hip-hop artist. Articulating my views in a way that is compelling and succinct, and making sure I articulate the concerns of the community very vocally, even in the face of opposition, the ability to bring people together and to move people to action are all things that we do as hip-hop artists.
I mean that we dreaming of freedom. The freedom is fleeting. By which I mean between seeing people beating and bleeding on our TVs, on the daily, on the weekly. I just want to relax a bit, crack a pap and watch some videos of cats and fish.
We have a lot of folks who, from their perspective, you know, they want good things. They want good things. We have a lot of folks here who want good stuff, but don't know what those things look like or how to get them.
Everyone want to complain about the state of the system, congratulate themselves on Facebook for paying attention, and homie, I know you're right, but if nobody mobilizes a noble fight, we stay enslaved for a century. And I wish some forgiving an ish would fix it. I wish giving an ish was as simple as whistling Dixie. The only way I have to fix it is cashing my chips in. So I guess to fix the system first, I have to fix me. So next week is gonna beat the rest of them. I'm waking up at 7, stretching and eating vegetables, cause beating my demons could never be fearsome. It's feeding them and feeling them, beating up on my eardrums.
So I think that the problem with progressives that talk a lot of talk is that they aren't in any direct contact with the folks, the true severity of the problems. And if we could create more cross-cultural or cross-community interactions where it's like, whoa, it's not just like talk about, you know, a brighter future and progress. It's like facing the conditions that their neighbors are really living in.
And better and better. We stick together, man. It's gonna get better and better.
You know, thinking more broadly than the needs of their themselves and their kids and their neighbors.
And better and better and better.
Thinking about their neighbors a little more. Vastly.
Better and better and better. Now people love me, but I find love to be a smug joke. Why y'all see things along humdrum rosa when the club folks cuss? Only alternative that I'm okay with taking razors to my veins until I'll leave my favorite sweat a stain of blood soaked. My facade is robotic, not often myself. Thinking about coffins and options, but often myself. I used to think that maybe talking to doctors would help. So we're taking 12 Oxycontins and maybe hopping. Oh well.
I get that I'm still not perfect. I'm working on a lot of things about me. And for a long time, I thought that precluded me from trying to do anything larger, you know, like, oh, well, yeah, I got this problem or that problem, or I'm this way or that way, and so I'm just going to stay home. Those things don't, those things shouldn't keep you from going out and, like, just trying to do insane stuff. I've just gotten over feeling afraid or bad about myself. Know that it's going to remain rocky forever, and that's okay.
That was rapper and Athens-Clark County Commissioner Lingua Franca speaking with GPB's Grant Blankenship. And that is it for our show today, but as always, we do want to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Yeah.